this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right?
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
Volcanic fury of Vesuvius. From the ravaged city of Pompeii, across 2,000 years, comes one of the strangest mysteries of all time. The curse of the faceless man. Spanned the centuries, crossed the dividing line between yesterday and today, between the past and the present, even between life and death.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 140, 1958's creature feature, Curse of the Faceless Man. Now, if you've not heard of Curse of the Faceless Man, but you have heard of The Incredible Melting Man and Curse of the Cat People, well, this does not come up in any top five list of either top curse of movies or top man movies, because this is fairly forgettable drive-in feature stuff from the 50s. Came and went with very little fanfare. We're not going to laud it here to say you have to rush out and go see it. If you have, good for you, and it would probably help to enjoy this discussion, but fairly weak 1950s film with high aspirations.
It's a creature feature that was designed to be, you know, second on the bill, whether it be a double feature at the, you know, the kiddie matinee or the local drive-in. That's the thing. You would have your A picture, and then you would have your first feature, and then you would have your second feature, which was the B feature. And that's sort of where the term B movie came from. They would associate the B movie with the lesser of the two, because obviously the first movie you would play would be the higher quality one.
Yeah, it's almost like an opening act for a concert. And that would be the B.
Well, but
except reversed, yeah. Because exactly. Yeah. No one even bothers going to see the opening act unless it's someone really good.
And a lot of people just get up after the first feature and leave.
Or
drive away. But I mean, yeah. this was played with It, The Terror from Beyond Space. And as a B feature, it's short. It's pretty cheap, I would say. But these creature features are fun. I mean, whether or not, you know, it's an A picture or a B picture, and I'm saying that strictly in the most literal sense of the word, because I really hate the term B movie, you know, mm-hmm. as we've talked about in the past.
For sure.
When people deride our favorite films as B movies. But yeah, it was sort of one of these films that sort of came and went and was swept into the dustbin of history.
Yeah.
And like one of the main characters in the movie, we are now going to unearth this movie and discuss it.
Yeah, because this is a historically tied film, and it's set in Pompeii, which I've had the pleasure of visiting. It was a city notoriously leveled, or raised, which is a weird word, because when you raise something, you usually lift something up. But okay, it was raised, it was crushed by a volcano. Raised with a, I forget how you spell it, but that always confuses me. I went there in like 2006, because I was obsessed with Pompeii as a kid, and seeing these bodies mid-struggle, trying to get out of their dirt tombs because they were buried alive, these poor people in Herculaneum and Pompeii in 79 AD. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is a terrific place to set a horror film because this place is horrific. As I said, when you go and see these skeletons that they've put in these plaster molds to, so you can see how they met their maker, it's quite moving. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how the people of Naples live under the shadow of this crazy volcano, Vesuvius. There's some people who say this is what makes Neapolitans nuts, because it's a fucked up place to begin with. It's full of mafia, but who would live under a volcano? And you can even walk up it, which is crazy too. Like, it could erupt at any moment.
Well,
and maybe that would have made for a better movie. Like, true. Maybe, yeah.
But I was going to say, my major association with Pompeii is, you know, the stellar concert film Pink Floyd Live at Pompeii.
Yes.
Is one of the most mind-blowing musical performances I've ever seen. Amazingly enough, I mean, when Pink Floyd was sort of on the rise, as they were recording Dark Side of the Moon, because they would have studio footage of that, they were, I guess this movie was made to sort of promote their, which I consider to be the absolute best Pink Floyd record, Metal, and they were performing songs from that record as well as some earlier stuff within the ruins of Pompeii.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised, because obviously there's no crowd, because they wouldn't have been able
to go.
But the vibrations from their amplifiers and their stacks, their Marshall stacks, might have knocked over the odd, like the 2,500-year-old temple from antiquity. Well, that's pretty crazy.
Unless they
faced it the other way or something.
I don't know. They worked with the Echoes, that's which is like, you know, a 26-minute long track, and it takes up the entire second side, or the first, whatever, one of the sides of the record Metal. Oh my God, and the camera was, you know, panning towards the ruins and back to the band and the music and perfect synchronicity. That was mind-blowing.
So much better than The Wizard of Oz, time to synchronize with Dark Side of the Moon?
I've never experienced that.
Yeah, I haven't either, but apparently for all the stoners out there, people have synced up the two films. Yeah, maybe we're high now. No, and exactly. Apparently they go very well together. So, but anyway, yeah, this is...
As does Nosferatu and Radiohead's Kid A, apparently.
Yes, apparently. Mm-hmm. So, beautiful, lush setting, the Neapolitan mountains and the Bay of Naples. There's a body that's found.
Right, and then this movie begins... You know, many a movie, a 50s creature feature, and also a lot of post-apocalyptic movies. You know, I always talk about the... voiceover and whatnot. It began with a voiceover, and he said, "Our story begins when blah 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 blah." But what's interesting about this voiceover was that it wasn't just there to establish a movie and then that's it. This thing continued throughout the movie to sort of connect it together, and that to me was very Ed Woodian. Mm-hmm. If you can't connect your movie just by the scenes alone.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder whether, like, was this intentional, or do they just have not enough footage for the finished product and then slap this on? You never can tell. It might have just added to running time, or who knows what. I don't think it benefited from having this at all. Well, like, it did not add to anything.
Ultimately, this movie is, from start to finish, 66 minutes long. It's not a long movie.
No.
So, if they had to pad it out somehow, that's...
that's really saying
and
something.
And speaking of padding, we start off with stock footage of what is supposed to be the eruption of Vesuvius and destruction of Pompeii. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not actual footage. That, you know... That technology did not exist back then. Nobody
unless they caught a maybe later iteration of the Mount Vesuvius eruption, and they ran at it with a camera. I don't know where they got it from.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, like nowadays...
It was not overly gripping.
Nowadays, instead of running for their lives, you know, residents of Naples would be taking out their cell phones and like
that.
You need to put it up on YouTube, but...
yeah, true enough. Yeah.
So, they established, you know, what happened there and this ill-fated eruption and what a calamitous event it was. And then... Like many...
Which is stupid, too. Okay, sorry to interject, but it's like, this is one of the defining moments of human history. It's almost like 1066. William the Conqueror goes to England. The Normans crush the English and the French appear there, or like 9/11 or like 1919 or the Paris whatever treaty and World War One. Like, who needs to explain what the hell happened at Vesuvius and Pompeii? That's a dumb voiceover.
But
certain things like 1492. Like, if you had a movie about Columbus, you need to say in 1492 an Italian explorer came to America. I'd be like, no, it's fucking Columbus. So you know what happened. But anyway, this is a digression. Thank you, voiceover. You inserted yourself numerous times in the span of a 60-minute movie. Like, that's crazy. Anyway, we find this body.
Yeah, we don't find this body.
No, no.
An archaeologist of some sort, yes. An excavator, finds the body. And actually, before he finds the body, he finds a box. And within this box are some rare antiquities of value, and also something that seems to be of little value, just a brass medallion. And as he's looking inside the box to notice the contents, we see this white hand come out. Yeah. When I say white, it would look like it was covered in some sort of plaster or calcium, perhaps.
Definitely
calcified. And next thing we know, we're in this museum in Naples. What was the name of the museum again?
The Museo di Pompei.
And there's this curator, and his name is Dr. Carlo Fiorello. And he's got his daughter, Maria. And they're all a-Twitter because of this wonderful discovery.
Probably what appealed to them more was the box of the jewelry.
Because the skeleton of secondary.
Yeah.
In fact, the body wasn't even there. It was in transport because they wanted to do a little bit of examination, perhaps eventually display it. But yeah, it was the contents of the box that I think they're more interested in. However, they enlisted the services of an American, one Dr. Paul Malin, and he's some sort of forensics dude. Like,
yeah, for sure.
He's supposed to, I don't know, carbon dated.
Yeah.
This thing was found whole, and it was encased in this crust, this outer shell, this plaster of some sort. If you're transporting a 2,000-year-old archaeological discovery, wouldn't you want to take certain precautions to ensure that it makes it from point A to point B?
Straw, styrofoam, peanuts.
Maybe a vehicle with a cover.
Yeah.
No, this thing is being driven.
It's like the Beverly Hillbillies of Italy. Yeah, in a pickup truck.
A pickup truck.
Yeah.
By Tony the driver. And as Tony is making his way down to the museum, the same hand that we saw earlier reach out from the, I guess you'd say, tomb, reaches out and grabs Tony, chokes him, and
sends the vehicle hurtling into the nearest ditch. Tony meets his demise. Mm-hmm.
And our intrepid academics, Dr. Mal and Dr. Fiorello, they get this call. My God, there's been a calamity. You know, this body.
Something happened, yeah. Let's say. And then the cops are sent to the scene because it's a fatal accident. Or that could be accident in quotes, because who knows what happened. And we have an inspector who is on the scene, and he suspects foul play. And this wasn't just Tony driving himself into the ditch, because I think there's a funny line that, what is it, Tony was always a good driver?
Tony cannot have an accident. He was such a reliable driver.
Reliable, okay, yeah.
And yeah, the other thing too is that when Dr. Malin investigates the body, and it's hilarious. Like, it just looks like a guy who's encased from head to toe in plaster. Mm. Sort of like, you know, if you were in some accident, you know, and broke every bone in your body.
Oh, I was going to lower the tone and say, in case you were a rock star from the 70s, getting your member encased in plaster.
But
again,
one part of the
body. Okay, yeah, this is the whole part, yeah.
And he notices that there's blood on the hand, and this would be Tony's blood.
Dr. Malin, you may begin your examination.
Wait a minute. This is blood.
I think you will find, Dr. Malin, that the blood is not from the creature, but from the wound that killed the truck driver.
Now look, Dr. Emanuel, I don't believe in this curse, and I don't believe that this thing killed Tony, and I don't believe that this thing is alive.
They determine, but there is a lot of skepticism that somehow Tony was murdered. Now, they surmise that it was, these were maybe after the, what was in the box?
Yeah, who knows? They're basically, they're open to any explanation at this point. All they found is this body and the dead Tony and the truck overturned. They don't know what to make of it. Still, they have their archaeological find. And
they have, you know, to translate what's on the medallion.
Yes.
And they have this this expert on, I guess, languages of antiquity.
Yes.
He's this very elderly gentleman by the name of Dr. Manuel, and he's got a really, his accent is very unique. He keeps going, I dagged the medallion. I translated what's on the medallion.
The medallion.
And the medallion is telling me that, and he's got this whole inscription with like a paragraph.
It was unbelievable how well it went on forever. It's a 66 minute movie.
What do you mean there could be more that could die?
This is the translation from the medallion. The house on the fourth hill of Pompeii shall fall. Its people shall perish, and whatsoever stands between me and what is mine shall perish. I visit a curse upon them until eternity. The fires of the earth shall consume them. I am the son of Etruscan gods. I will live when the Roman is no more. It is signed Quintilius Aurelius.
Well, this is Etruscan language, the language that predated early Latin languages, and Etruscan culture. This is an Etruscan slave of the Romans.
But what I was going to say is there's no way that this paragraph of text, even though when it was translated, could have fit on a medallion the size
Well, maybe it was like 4-point font. I don't know. Maybe it was like on the, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe there's more in the box. I don't know. We find out this is an ex-slave by the name of Quintilius Aurelius. A la Marcus Aurelius, who knows, or Quintilius Aurelius. It's said different ways throughout the movie.
Again, very Edwardian.
Yes, and so he was obviously captured and meant to fight for the amusement of people of ancient Rome. Mm-hmm. An interesting backstory, to say the least.
He indicates that I am the son of the Etruscan gods, and I will live when the Roman is no more.
Yeah, the Etruscans inhabited southern Italy before Rome took it over.
But was there was a connection with the Etruscans and the Egyptians, I believe, right?
Because in this case, yes. So if we're trusting the producers of Curse of the Faceless Man, apparently, and it's not a big stretch because various cultures adopted the gods and mythology of others. So this guy, Quintilius Aurelius, has something to do with Egyptian black magic.
Alchemy.
Alchemy, yeah. And at one point, our researcher, the American Paul, is given a set of books on alchemy to try and decode. I guess he's got some accoutrements from ancient Egypt as well. He's involved in alchemy. Hell, I'm not going to question it. Romans took Greek gods. Etruscans took Egyptian gods. Hell, let's run with it. I'm buying it.
Okay. Anyway, here's the thing. I'm just going to explain this plot. One more minute. So, Dr. Mallon, he has a fiancée that's also living there in Naples. Her name is Tina Enright, and she's an artist. And she paints this picture that resembles the find, Quintilius Aurelius, or the fucking
famous.
Yes. And when Paul comes back and he sees it, after having seen the actual body, he's amazed. How did you do this?
And she's been plagued by nightmares of this thing. And she's been painting it, so she's obsessed with this thing.
She describes this vivid dream, and it would basically describe everything that had just transpired. The car crash, this, and this, and
She's a cipher for the plaster caster creature. And this is, even though we're watching it, it's explained by the voiceover, which says, the strange dreams persisted.
She gets up in the middle of the night and walks into the museum. Now, I don't know how she got into the museum. Most museums are locked at night.
Yeah, for some reason. And I think it was somnambulism as well, if I'm not mistaken. She walks into the museum, starts to sketch the creature. The creature comes alive.
Well, don't forget, there was also a night watchman.
Barely stood a chance. He was done for.
Right.
Creature comes alive, takes out the night watchman.
And she passed out. She's in absolute shock. Now, that was a pretty cool scene. When the creature got up and sort of stalked, you know, sort of mummy-like.
Yeah.
That was cool.
It was neat.
Yeah.
And again, because this is a sign of the times, when women were depicted in this period, I'd say any time between 1950s and 60s, there's always that they can't handle themselves in a crisis. She passes right out and she enters into what they describe as a vague twilight, where she's just knocked out cold. And you see this all the time. In Planet of the Vampires, where you had, again, a scientist who she sees something untoward, passes right out. Yeah, so when this mummy creature wakes up, takes out the night watchman, all the researchers come running, police come running, this creature is on the loose.
So the rest of this movie, as it turns out, he's like the reincarnation of this slave's long-lost love, and he wants to,
reunite with her.
Right.
Because she, in some trance, in some transcendental state, starts describing the particulars of living in ancient Pompeii, and she, I guess they find out she is the betrothed of this Quintilius Aurelius character. She's in some way being sought after by Quintilius Aurelius, whose restless corpse cannot find rest until he finds this woman.
They had this ill-fated love affair because he was an aristocrat and he was a slave. Now, ultimately, the other thing that was kind of thrown in there is, you know, why is this corpse reanimated? Okay, we know what he's trying to do. We know he's the son of the Etruscan gods. He's not resting until the Romans are gone, whatever.
Well, then he could have rested for another 400 years when the Germans took over Rome. But, like, so he waited 3,000 years. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
They have to throw in just a little bit of scientific rationale for why he's reanimated.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was...
It was radiation.
Hoary...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Trope, the radiation, and they attribute it to the X-ray machine.
Yes, of all things. Oh my God, the X-ray machine. But again, what else could you have done? I mean, on a budget like this, you can't. They could not have recreated an asteroid hitting Earth or any of the other motifs that would have run through the radiation film. So, the lab X-ray machine did it.
And when they X-rayed the body, somehow. Animated previously dormant cells.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Into that. And ultimately, it comes down to a hunt for this creature before he takes Tina to a watery grave. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much it.
That's the curse
of the faceless man.
Yeah, well, lots to learn. We can definitely come up with things we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
Some choice lines in this film. One of my favorite lines, they're in a quandary about what to do with this quote-unquote stone corpse, which is walking around killing people. And the one guy, I think it's the cop, says, "You're scientists, how do you kill it?" Well, they don't know. Like, they just shoot at it, and at various points the cops just swarm at this thing and just fire a bunch of lead at it, which of course does nothing. And another terrific line is, Paul, the American skeptic, says, "At this point I'll believe anything, even if it's the Egyptian black arts." There's a voiceover line about the strange dreams that persisted as Tina, the artist, was plagued by nightmares of the stone corpse. And she was plagued by nightmares of the white dead hand. So, yeah, there's great lines like this, which I always love. Like, I love ominous voices talking about dead things. So, what did you learn?
Yeah, this is a very economical picture. In a sense, and I mean that.
I was going to say parsimonious, but economical is good. That's a great way of saying cheap.
Well, but yeah,
stock footage of the Bay of Naples, and who knows where the rest of this was filmed, and no budget.
There is maybe three sets, two locations, and maybe a grand total of, let's say, eight actors in the entire movie.
Yeah.
So at the end of the movie, when they have now accepted the fact that this creature is reanimated and he's after Tina and he's on the loose and they're trying to hunt him down, and they form this dragnet where they're closing the circle of Naples around him, and the inspector says, every cop within, because you've been to Naples, what is the population of Naples?
Probably 500,000.
Okay, so are you telling me that in a city with a population of 500,000 people, there are four cops?
And this is one of the most corrupt cities in Italy, so you could not amass anybody at a moment's notice to do fucking anything, because this is a bureaucratic nightmare, this place. Everyone is on the take, full of mafia. It would take you like a good 2 weeks to get all these police mobilized, but anyway. The creature is knows the streets of Naples, because even though they've been changed by modernity, Naples is still pretty old, and the creature is guided by instinct and wandering around the street, cops cannot find him.
Because he's got no eyes, you know?
No, he is the faceless man. Yeah.
But I just found it hilarious, because we have every cop in Naples, and they all just sit on this beach, and there's four cops and the inspector.
Yeah, for sure. And they're just trying to fill him full of lead. It's not working. What are they going to do? Well, they're completely ineffectual cops. King Kong style, Quintilius, I have to keep looking at my notes for this, sorry, Aurelius hoists the damsel up on his shoulder, which would be Tina, walks into the Bay of Naples with her. And the big denouement is the creature disintegrates. And all that plaster just dissolves into the blue waters of the Mediterranean Sea.
And Dr. Paul rescues his betrothed from drowning in 2 feet of water.
Of course. And of course, that doffs his suit and strips down all manly man 1950s style to do it. The end. Done. Done like dinner. And I guess, is this the star rating point here? I guess a 2 for me, because even though this is 66 minutes, it feels like the passage of time from antiquity to now, from Roman times. Like I felt every minute of this going by. Some pretty weak kills. Like you said, when it reanimates in the museum, it was pretty neat. The kills involved, I believe,
SWAT.
A SWAT or a sort of 2-bit karate chop to the night watchman.
Mm-hmm.
And poor Tony, the pickup driver, was just basically shoved or grabbed by the neck and he just went into the ditch. So, like, very weak kills, not much to commend this. A curiosity of its time that doesn't transcend its time, like Invaders from Mars or
It Came from Outer Space.
Yeah, like, that kind of really infused with terror. Mm-hmm. This it really
from another world,
yeah.
Which of course was an amazing thing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So this slipped through the cracks. Yeah, deservedly so.
Yeah.
Your rating?
Yeah, no, I'm gonna give it 2 stars as well. I mean, look, for 66 minutes, you could do better, you could do worse. It's got a kind of a cool, interesting looking creature, the Curse of the Faceless Man. There's one or two creepy moments when he does arise from his slumber, but overall, yeah.
And for more, check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Fun reviews 3 times a week. And new episodes of the podcast uploaded every Friday for your listening pleasure. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.